Their Image and Past and Disneyfication of Pure Terrorism. By Adjacent Possible. Bloody Friday. Bloody Friday was one of the worst atrocities of the Northern Ireland Troubles, but you will seldom hear it mentioned. It was the deliberate targeting of civilians by the Provisional IRA, PIRA, with approximately 20 bombs detonated in 80 minutes of horror around Belfast. Others were defused or failed to explode, murdering 9 people and injuring 130. Yet there is virtual silence surrounding these wanton acts of terrorism. Media and political attention tends to be directed to those with an effective propaganda machine. Compare and contrast the lack of attention that Bloody Friday attracts with the tsunami of media coverage devoted to every pure Sinn Féin allegation of wrongdoing by the British state. Cold-blooded murder by Irish Republicans does not fit the post-ceasefire, Re-image and Past and Disneyfied version of terrorism that pure Sinn Féin has manufactured. The media, British government and others seem willing not only to accept pure Sinn Féin's Re-image and Past, but to indulge them by propagating the lies on their behalf. Bloody Friday did not happen in isolation. In the months leading up to the terrorist atrocity on 21 July 1972, Pira had inadvertently developed the car bomb whilst trying to dispose of a homemade explosive device without wasting it. They did this by simply placing it in a car and driving it into the centre of Belfast, for detonation. The birth of the car bomb led to carnage, with an explosion in March 1972 in Donegal Street, causing multiple casualties including 7 deaths. This attack clearly involved the cynical shepherding of pedestrians into the vicinity of the bomb. The intentional targeting of civilians was also apparent 2 weeks earlier, with a bomb explosion inside the Abercorn restaurant that again caused multiple casualties, including 2 deaths. These 2 attacks display not just a willingness to endanger civilians by placing bombs in public places, but a calculated strategy of terror that accepts civilians will be killed and maimed. It was designed to weaken the resolve of the public and force the British government into negotiations, ultimately leading to withdrawal from Northern Ireland. Pira's strategy of terror was emboldened by both the development of the car bomb and the newly acquired high-powered Armalite rifles, smuggled across the Atlantic on the QE2, in an operation run by leading Pira terrorist Brendan Hughes, allegedly at the behest of his friend and OC, Gerry Adams, despite the objections of Pira's leadership in Dublin. This was a sign of things to come, as a younger, more militant faction of Pira, from north of the border, would gradually take control of the terrorist organization. The final push. Although he claims to have never been a member of the IRA, Gerry Adams has been identified repeatedly by informed commentators and PIRA personnel as being a leading figure within Belfast PIRA in the early 1970s. It has been said that he was part of a triumvirate, along with Brendan Hughes and Ivor Bell, that quickly came to the fore, rising through the ranks in the first few years of the Troubles. Hughes was also a close friend of Adams, who acknowledged that he not only respected Adams, but that he was like a brother, who had once helped to save his life by arranging medical treatment for Hughes after he had been shot by the British Army. In March 1972, Gerry Adams was on the run, evading arrest during the era of internment. His luck ran out when he returned home to visit his wife and the army swooped in an early morning raid. Adams was interned, but his time as a guest in Longkesh prison was short-lived. Negotiations were underway between PIRA and the British government regarding a ceasefire and secret talks. One precondition for a ceasefire was made clear by Adams' comrade and fellow member of the Belfast Triumvirate, Ivor Bell. Without the release of Gerry Adams, there would be no ceasefire. This was a turning point in the life of Gerry Adams. His moment had arrived. Without this release, he may have spent years in prison whilst events outside continued on without him. Image. Hughes, Adams, Booby Sands and others in Longkesh. Just days after Adams was released from prison, he accompanied senior peer remembered Theo Conaill to a pre-ceasefire meeting on the Derry-Donegal border, where he sat down with a Northern Ireland official, Philip Woodfield and Frank Steele from MI6. It is worth remembering that Adams was still only 23 years old at the time, but yet Peer valued him so highly that they had secured his freedom and included him in secret meetings with the British. The Peer ceasefire started at midnight on 26 June 1972, and less than 2 weeks later, a Peer delegation was flown by the RAF to London for a meeting with the Home Secretary William Whitelaw and various officials at a flat in Cheyne Walk. The Peer delegation consisted of the Chief of Staff, Sean McSchioffane, his Adjutant Theo Connell, Belfast Brigade Commander Seamus Tomey, Ivor Bell, Martin McGuinness, Gerry Adams and a lawyer. By all accounts the meeting achieved nothing, with no willingness displayed by Peer for compromise on their position, which included full British withdrawal from Northern Ireland by the start of 1975. Yet again, although Gerry Adams continues his denial of membership of Peer, claiming that his involvement in the secret talks was only as a representative of the Irish Republican movement, the Peer Chief of Staff at the time said, in a BBC documentary about the IRA, that everyone on the delegation was Peer. When asked if this included Gerry Adams, he said that it did. Image: Martin McGuinness, Theo Connell, Sean McSchioffane and Seamus Tomey. This photo of a 1972 Peer press conference shows four members of the delegation that went to London and gives you some indication of the circles within which Gerry Adams was moving. From the left, a young Martin McGuinness, the commander of Peer's Derry Brigade, who would several years later become OC of Northern Command and the Chief of Staff, Peer Adjutant General and political strategist Theo Connell, Chief of Staff Sean McSchioffane, Belfast Brigade Commander Seamus Tomey. Image: Ivor Bell. This is a picture of Ivor Bell, another member of the Peer delegation to London. Bell was a leading player in Peer's Belfast Brigade and insisted that the release Gerry Adams from Longkesh prison was one of the preconditions for the 1972 ceasefire. Bell would eventually become a member of the Peer Army Council, briefly its chief of staff in the early 1980s and also, in a turn of events, an opponent of Gerry Adams. Image: Gerry Adams, Brendan Hughes. This is a picture of Brendan Hughes with his friend and comrade Gerry Adams in happier times as prisoners inside Longkesh. Hughes, even before this, had a fearsome reputation and figured highly on police, army wanted lists. 12 days after the start of the ceasefire commenced, it ended when a dispute between Protestant and Catholics in the Lenadoon area of Belfast, fueled and exploited by extremists on both sides, with the British Army stuck in the middle, descended into rioting and then gunfire from Peer. Brendan Hughes, along with two other Peer members, were the gunmen involved in the shooting incident that day, acting under orders from Peer's Belfast commander Seamus Tomey. Tomey was a leading player in the Lenadoon dispute, and it would not be unreasonable to suppose that the standoff was viewed by Peer as an opportunity to end the ceasefire, whilst blaming others. A theme that runs through Peer's history is that they shift the blame for everything onto someone else, completely ignoring their own responsibility. It is a script that terrorists around the world follow, and every script is just a variation on the same theme. They play the role of victims, but to do so, they need to assign the role of aggressor and/or oppressor onto others. It is debatable whether Peer had entered into the secret talks with the intent of compromise and a deal, but I would suggest it unlikely. From Peer's perspective, they were in the ascendancy and they felt that victory was achievable. They would have seen the imposition of direct rule earlier in the year as a victory over Unionism and Stormont, and rightly or wrongly, this move by the British had sent Peer a signal that one final push would be all it would take to force British withdrawal. The hardliners within the Peer leadership therefore felt no need to compromise, and with the end of the ceasefire, a plan to explode multiple car bombs in Belfast was put into play. The operational commander for what became known as Bloody Friday was Brendan Hughes. Whilst he was not responsible for the creation of the plan, It was his job to implement it, using a number of teams to construct the bombs and PIRA members, or volunteers, from the three Belfast battalions, to transport the bombs to their civilian targets. Hughes would later state that he hadn't intended killing anyone, but he also said, "And I knew that there was going to be casualties. It was a major, major operation, but we never intended to kill anyone that day. I would suggest that if you are involved in leaving over 20 bombs in Belfast, all due to detonate in public places within 80 minutes, and you have accepted that there will be casualties, then you also knew some of their casualties may be civilian fatalities. Saying otherwise was simply reluctance to accept foreknowledge of what would likely happen." Hughes' regret and guilt, decades later, may have been genuine, but I do not believe Pirro acted without knowing civilians would probably die. Bloody Friday was intended to shock the British. It was part of the final push. Civilian deaths and injuries was part of the price for victory. A means to an end. Pirro knew only too well about the risks to civilians from bomb attacks, but this did not deter them. I would contend that what occurred on Bloody Friday was not a mistake. It was intentional. Bloody Friday was the continuance of a Pirro strategy of terror against the civilian population. The propaganda template had already been created. They would blame the actions of the security forces for civilian casualties. The same would happen again following Bloody Friday, even suggesting that it was a British strategy to allow civilians casualties, despite Pirro warnings. Whilst Hughes was operational commander for the wave of bombs, during his taped testimony for Boston College, he made it clear that it was not solely his responsibility. He said the entire Belfast Brigade staff planned and approved the bombings. That included Seamus Tomey, the brigade commander, his adjutant Jerry Adams, and the brigade operations officer, Ivor Bell. Hughes went on to say that whilst Tomey was the brigade commander, in effect, Jerry was the real OC. Tomey was practically out of it by that stage, to the extent that eventually we sent him down to Dublin. Jerry was always the OC. Even if he was not OC in name, Jerry was the man who made the decisions. Hughes would go to his grave, feeling bitter and betrayed, by Pirro and his former friend Jerry Adams, for taking the organization down the political road and, as he saw it, selling out the cause for which he had fought, served time in prison and ruined his health on hunger strike. He also expressed anger that Jerry Adams claimed to have never been a member of Pirro, therefore leaving the likes of Hughes and Bell to take responsibility for violence such as Bloody Friday. As the bombs started to explode across Belfast on that Friday afternoon, Pirro supporters in Republican areas cheered every explosion. With a mixture of so many bombs in such a short space of time, combined with hoax bomb alerts, the security forces and emergency services were stretched, possibly the intention of Pirro. This made it difficult, if not impossible, to respond on time to every bomb alert. Due to the close proximity of the bombs, people were also being unknowingly evacuated from one bomb towards another as yet unreported bomb. The horror that followed was inevitable. The victims. The nine people murdered on Bloody Friday, 21st of July 1972, were killed by bomb blasts at two of the locations, the Ulster Bus Depot in Oxford Street and on the Cave Hill Road. Jackie Gibson, 45, Ulster Bus driver. William Grothers, 15, employee of Ulster Bus. William Irvine, 18, employee of Ulster Bus. Thomas Killips, 39, employee of Ulster Bus. Stephen Cooper, 18, soldier, killed at the Ulster Bus Depot whilst trying to clear the area. Philip Price, 27, soldier, killed at the Ulster Bus Depot whilst trying to clear the area. Margaret O'Hare, 34, married mother of seven children. Killed inside her car by the Cave Hill Road bomb. Margaret's 11-year-old daughter was with her in the car and was badly injured. Bridget Murray, 65, killed by the Cave Hill Road bomb. Image. Stephen Parker. Stephen Parker, 14, schoolboy, killed whilst trying to warn others in nearby shops of a car bomb he had spotted on the Cave Hill Road. Stephen was identified by his father at the mortuary by a box of trick matches that he had been carrying in his pocket, and the shirt and scout belt that he had been wearing. Stephen was posthumously awarded the Queen's Commendation for bravery. Another 130 people were injured by the bombs, many of them sustaining horrific, life-changing injuries. In closing, I will simply say that in my view, despite what Pyrrha Sinn Féin may claim, the outcome of Bloody Friday was intentional. Pyrrha terrorists set out to murder, maim, destroy and terrorize, and that is what they did. It was not the first time that they had employed a strategy of terror, and it would not be the last time. Only 10 days later, Pyrrha would detonate 3 more no-warning car bombs in the village of Clawdy, near Londonderry, murdering 9 civilians. Again, we are meant to believe it was unintentional, that 10 days after Bloody Friday, Pyrrha could not foresee the risk of leaving car bombs in busy streets. The only positive note from this horror is that the Pyrrha strategy of terror against civilian targets, designed to be the final push against the British, was probably the beginning of the end for Pyrrha. The unintended consequence of Pyrrha's actions was to provoke a feeling of revulsion amongst the majority of Protestant and Catholics that ensured Pyrrha could not achieve the level of support they had hoped for. The tragedy is that it would take another quarter of a century for Pyrrha to finally accept physical force republicanism was the road to nowhere. They, of course, would spin that rather differently. Whether Gerry Adams was ever in Pyrrha is for others to decide. Is he telling the truth, or is his version of events his own image and past? Is the Gerry Adams of today a Disney-fied, theme park, family-friendly version of Gerry Adams? That, dear reader, is for you to decide. This article is reproduced with the kind permission of Umbra Voices and has been edited by Colin Cross. It is part of an ongoing series. Copyright adjacent possible 2019.